Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger and I'm joined today by Ian Wenig. Ian, how's it going?
Oh, doing fantastic. Thank you for asking.
How's the back? We haven't done a back check-in for a while.
Good. No, things are going well.
Things are going well.
Not up to running yet, but we're getting there.
No one's running, to be fair. It's 100 degrees in New York City right now. I say no one. No one who lives in New York is, I imagine, doing a lot of outdoor running right now.
You'd be surprised. You see some psychopaths going out in the day.
Yeah, well, good luck to them, frankly. Speaking of psychopaths, no, that's unfair. Hey, Sam, Sabajarski, you're here with us. How's it going?
Doing pretty well. Happens to be my birthday. So
it's your birthday today?
Feeling good, yeah.
I feel like I should have known
on a podcast.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
If I'd have been more organized, we could have had a cake on the pod, which would have been, you know, brilliant piece of audio for those. Can I ask how old you are?
I am 32.
32. That's a great age. 32. One of the great. 28 through about 33. I mean, that is, you know, it's good.
Yeah.
It's good times.
Hope I haven't peaked yet.
Yeah, you've got a couple of years, I think. Good stuff. Well, look, thank you both for being here. We've got a lot to get through today, as ever. And we're going to start, Sam, with you and a story that you broke this week, which is a kind of update to an ongoing lawsuit between Mega RIA Carson Group. We can call them a Mega RIA.
They are a Mega RIA.
We'll do a separate podcast at some point about how we determine internally, you know, when to use Mega RIA and other adjectives, which I'm sure will be of interest to like seven people. But anyway, Mega RIA Carson Group and an ongoing lawsuit or legal situation they have with their former chief marketing officer. Now, there's been an update in that suit, which is very interesting, but we're not going to start there. I suppose we should start with the suit itself, which dates back to April of last year, and maybe fill us in on that. And then when we've kind of got through that context, we can talk about what the latest twist here is.
Yeah. So September of 2022, at a company conference, Carson Group's chief marketing officer, Mary Kay Gulick, says that she heard about a sexual assault that involved a Carson Group employee. This is a unnamed employee who is apparently non-managerial. So she hears about the assault. She reports it up the chain of command. And when she does, Carson basically doesn't discipline the employee. In her suit, you know, she details just some mental health impacts that she suffered as a result of hearing about the assault, and as a result of the response. You know, she puts in there, you know, there's major depressive disorder, PTSD, things like that.
This was obviously triggered by the fact that this event, alleged assault, happened, but also by what she says was the company's response, or indeed lack of response, to doing anything about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is from 22, we're now into 23, and she's sort of dealing with the fallout from this, and obviously what she's alleged is a lack of action from the firm in anything here. And according to her initial suit, she says this has a big impact on her and her mental health.
This is in early 2023, a couple months after she reported the alleged assault.
Okay, so the alleged assailant wasn't fired, which is obviously something that she said she didn't agree with. And then in 23, she asked for medical leave.
Yes. She asked for medical leave. The company told her that she would either have to use paid time off or take the leave unpaid. She had a lot of conversations with other executives at the time, and was very unhappy with the response she got.
Okay. And then I'm just reading this now. So it says that per her suit, she said that as a result of this, and she needed to leave because she had major depressive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic brain impairment, and would need to see a mental health professional for the next year.
Yeah.
So obviously we know this didn't end well because there is a lawsuit, but what ultimately happened there? They declined that paid leave, and ultimately she left the firm. When did she leave the firm?
Yeah, they declined the paid leave. They declined her request for paid leave, and she detailed in the suit that she was fired from the firm by Bert White, who's currently the CEO of Carson Group, in June of 2023.
Okay, good. All right. Well, not good, but understood. So June of 23, she's fired, and then in April of 24, she files this suit, which effectively makes the allegations which we've just recapped now. Yeah. And I'm assuming Carson Group responds at some point to these allegations. And what's their side of the story here?
Yeah, well, they said that the employee in question denied the accusation that there was a sexual assault. That was at the crux of their reply back in May of last year.
And they investigated it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The firm did say they investigated it and you know, came to the conclusion that Gulick's claims are false, essentially.
Okay. Wow. And then in terms of what they said with regards to, I don't know, her allegations about her mental health and how it wasn't handled, did they respond to that at all?
I didn't take that up in great detail, but they basically denied the accusations in their filing last year.
Okay, got it. And then broadly since then, it's been pretty quiet until your story this week, or I suppose in response to the filings which were filed this month, which were a series of what, requests for subpoenas. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, Carson has filed its intent to subpoena phone records of Mary Kate Gulick, as well as her medical insurance records, and records from her from a prior employer, TD Ameritrade, just on like recorded work absences and any accommodations that she might have received at that employer, just to kind of gather evidence for its own case.
Okay, so I don't know an awful lot about how these kind of suits work, but I feel like just in our coverage, I've never seen something like this. Is that fair, unfair, Ian? You obviously are across this space a lot. We don't often see, you know, and I appreciate sort of calling this an employment dispute maybe trivializes some of it, which is not our intention, but that is effectively what it is. We don't normally see this kind of thing, do we?
I mean, we have reported on some suits about retaliation, wrongful termination, discrimination. I would say that what I think makes this a unique case is the granularity of detail that was put out in the original complaint. The fact that Mary Kate is a fairly recognizable name in the industry. She just got a job as the chief marketing officer of Moneta Group, which is a very well-known large RIA based in St. Louis. I think also the fact that there are certain documents included in there that give us a window into Carson's operations that I think say something about how this business has changed as outside investors have come in and the business has professionalized as well.
Okay, well, we'll come on to sort of the history of Carson in a minute. But yeah, so Sam, in terms of these subpoenas and things, so what happens next there? They've asked for permission for them. They haven't necessarily... They haven't subpoenaed the records yet. Will they definitely get them?
They filed their intent to a subpoena. Yeah. So it depends on whether what they can get if these companies cooperate. If they challenge that in any way.
And what does that speak to? That speaks to them obviously sort of ramping up this battle. It doesn't look as if they're sort of shying away from anything here.
Yeah. They've been very, very upfront about denying her accusations, and they're just trying to gather evidence for their case. It's, you know, still in the discovery phase.
Okay, so yeah, don't expect it to go away quietly anytime soon.
Yeah, it's gonna stay around.
Interesting. Okay. Well, look, thank you very much indeed, Sam. And Ian, you sort of hinted there in your answer about kind of how Carson has changed. So obviously, we used the phrase earlier to describe them a mega RIA. And Sam, I think you 42
billion in assets is where they are now. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is obviously a huge amount, puts them, you know, really in the upper end of that sort of large RIA space. And obviously, they've always been a big name. But Ian, yeah, could you download from your head a quick brief history of Carson Group, how they got to be this sort of huge firm that they are today from, you know, like many RIAs, a kind of founder-led business not that long ago.
Yeah, so Carson Group, based in Omaha, Nebraska, now about $42 billion in assets. Founding story dates back to the 1980s when Ron Carson, a former Nebraska football player, founded the company, I believe, out of his dorm room at UNL, Lincoln. The company grew over time. It was at first a major LPL Financial affiliate, then eventually moved over to Cetera Financial Group. Now it is, again, one of the largest independent RIAs in the country. In 2021, Bain Capital made a minority investment in Carson at a $1 billion valuation. Ron Carson kept his majority interest in the company and shortly thereafter stepped away as CEO, still obviously has that majority stake. And he was eventually replaced by Burt White, who was a former executive at LPL.
CIO, I think.
Yes, he was the first person that CityWire ever profiled in the US, the first cover of the first ProBuyer issue.
That's correct. And I think Ron Carson was the first cover star of our RAA magazine. We no longer have print magazines. Listener, if you're worried that you're missing out, you're not. But there's a tremendous back catalog, including work from Ian and Sam, which, you know, frankly, was great. But anyway,
that was a memorable cover.
Yeah, not the point of this to plug our back catalog. But okay, so Ron stepped away in 2020.
I believe it was around 2022. And so for context,
Burt White had joined as sort of chief marketing officer or something initially, or
he was in a top advisory role and then moved into CEO.
Okay.
So these are, I'm reading these, these are included in Mary Kate Gulick's complaint. And these are screenshots of Teams messages purportedly from Burt White. I am very proud and thankful for you being a pro at an org that isn't. How you have kept it together, performed with grace, and hourly maintained your sanity is, well, frankly, one of the greatest professional acts I've ever seen. Full stop. I'm fighting against all of what Carson is, like I'm rejecting a bad organ implant. It feels like a company that says all is good, while just under the surface is a swirl of discontent. This firm needs a sharp right turn, and frankly, this company is driven horribly. So those messages were in 2022 when Burt first joined, and he was named CEO in early 2024.
Okay. Did they respond to those messages? Because obviously those messages got out in the media because it was included in this lawsuit. When they responded to the lawsuit, did they respond to those messages? Did they address any of those?
I'm honestly,
in their response to the lawsuit or in their sort of public dealings with press or anything?
No, I don't think they responded to those, and they admitted too that like all of Gulick's conversations with executives took place. They're just denying, you know, like why she was fired. And
okay, yeah, the substance of her case is in that, you know, they're saying the assault didn't take place, and they're questioning her,
and the retaliatory firing didn't happen. Yeah. Yes,
yeah. Okay, got it. All right, just so we're sort of clear from a legal point of view. All right, so go back to the sort of history of Carson. So Carson, in that kind of post-Bain world, begins to change. Is that fair? Or we think it might?
That's correct. So, I mean, I think it's worth noting that, one, we had a lot of the major executives in the organization who were considered kind of loyalists to Ron have left the company. So that includes Aaron Chabin and Terry Shepard, who are both co-presidents of the firm. Aaron Chabin now has a role running Ron's personal family office. It's also worth noting that Ron has actually since changed his name to Omani Carson, has become really interested in mysticism, actually. So he's kind of taken a step back from the wealth management industry, and he's still like a public-facing figure, but he's really more focused on mysticism and spirituality. So it's a kind of a change in terms of how he engages with the world at large.
Okay, got it. And he's changed his name. So, apologies if we've used his wrong name at the wrong time, then, if he's now going by a different name. Okay, understood. So where does this leave Carson? Still massive. Yes. Still got obviously majority controlled by Omani, and obviously Bain's still there. What's next for that firm?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question for them is, look, you know, we're at 4 years into the private equity value chain, 4 years into Bain holding investment in this company. I think that we'll see Bain try to at least partially exit at some point in the next couple of years. What would be interesting then is whether Omani chooses to either exit entirely or trim his stake even further and take some more chips off the table. So I think that something is coming soon. The other thing to note is also, and this is similar to kind of what we've talked about with Hightower, is that Carson historically had a couple different affiliation models. One is sort of affiliating with your in-house RIA, and the other is acting as a partner firm where you pay a basis point fee for access to their investment platform and their tech stack. And Carson, as a company, has begun acquiring a lot of those partner-affiliated practices, taking more control of the assets, and that's a higher margin business. So I expect to see a lot more of that as well.
Got it, yeah. Stickier, better business,
yes.
All on one platform, all the things that sort of PE firms like, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you both. Complicated and at times sensitive story. So thank you both for sort of handling that and getting through all the history. Now, for something, I guess, a little lighter. Sam, last week we were here and we were talking about a survey that we'd done at San Diego, which would basically, our readers had said, hey, look, an IPO for an RIA is not something that we're going to see anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lo and behold, on Monday, an RIA filed for an IPO. So it was Wealthfront. So it's not exactly a conventional RIA, but yeah. Guys, what happened here? What's the story?
Yeah. I mean, so Wealthfront revealed on Monday that they had filed an S-1 with the Securities and Exchange Commission on a confidential basis that they intend to go public. So I think it's worth noting first that there are a lot of steps to go from a confidential S-1 filing to actually ringing the opening bell. First thing you have to do is obviously eventually unseal that S-1. You have to do a roadshow. And then, of course, you have to have someone run the book, price the offering, and then sell it. So we've had people do this before. The best example that I can come up with off the top of my head was Corient, which was the RIA arm of CI Financial. CI filed an S-1 on a confidential basis for Corient to publicly float a portion of that equity. The S-1 never got unsealed, and Corient wound up selling a minority stake in itself to a consortium of investors led by, coincidentally, Bain. And then CI ultimately sold itself entirely to Mubadala Capital, which is affiliated with Abu Dhabi in the UAE. So long step way to go there. Then Dynasty Financial Partners, we've written about them frequently. Big RA middle and back office service platform. They actually unsealed their S-1, but never ultimately priced the shares, never went to market, and they ultimately did a private capital raise instead with Avery Partners coming in.
Okay, great. So the question here would be, in your skeptical that we will see this business IPO, would that be fair?
Yes, I'm skeptical. So I was talking to a couple of sources after the fact, and one of them basically likened this to an old school move, which is that you file the S-1 as an advertisement for someone to come and acquire you. And look, you know, a couple of years ago, Wealthfront had a deal to sell itself to UBS, and that deal ultimately fell apart. So we know that they've tried to find an exit, a monetization event before. They tried the strategic sale. It didn't work. They're trying the IPO now, allegedly. Who's to say it's not going to end with another strategic coming in?
Got it. Okay. And then look, we've done a deep dive on Carson. I don't think we have time today to do a deep dive on Wealthfront, but very quickly, I mean, it's, you know, we joked, Sam, that, you know, it's, you know, we said an RIA will never IPO, and literally 4 days later, one files for one, but it's not your conventional RIA, is it? I mean, it's a robo-advisor.
Yes, exactly. I think it's worth noting that, one, robo-advisors work with smaller dollar clients, which are lower margin, and the cost of customer acquisition is very high. So honestly, we don't even know 100% if Wealthfront is profitable. We know that Betterment got to profitability a couple of years ago, but in general, the conventional wisdom is that if you are a robo, you have to scale up big time and quickly to get to profitability.
Unfair question, because we probably don't have this to hand, but, you know, sort of in terms of scale, so it's a $35 billion. It's got about 381,000 clients plus another, sorry, mass affluent investors plus another, let's say, 5,000 high net worth investors. Where does that sort of put it in the robo world?
It's right up there with Betterment. I will also clarify, Wealthfront in 2024, Forbes reported this, that they did pull in $89 million of EBITDA off $200 million in revenue in 2023. So they have declared themselves profitable. Obviously, we'll see what the margins are like in the S-1, but they have declared profitability. So they're right up there with Betterment. Betterment, they were well north of, I think, like $50 billion in discretionary last time we wrote about them.
Got it. Okay, so smaller than Betterment, but still up there. And those two are kind of the poster children for the sort of standalone robo businesses, yes. Which, you know, at one point was going to take over the advice world, but, you know, haven't. But those two firms do seem to have made a decent fist.
They have made some headway, yes.
And obviously, like you say, the cost of client acquisition is high, but then obviously the cost of running those clients is low.
Yes, because it's low ongoing cost of ongoing service.
You're not, because that quote unquote robo is doing it all for you. Okay, really interesting. Well, look, I guess watch this space as to whether our audience is proven right and whatever. I can't remember the stat now, Sam, but so 2028 to 2030 is when anyone thought we might.
Most people thought, most people thought 2028 to, 2033 or something like that. Yeah, and then the third thought it was a pipe dream.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. So look, we could still be, I say we, or indeed our event attendees could still be proven right. Interesting. Okay, so look, we're going to round off with, I would say, the sort of the story of the year, the ongoing story that, you know, could we call it the gift that keeps giving? Maybe. But this is LPL's deal to buy Commonwealth. Regular listeners and readers will know Citywire broke that story. Kudos to Ian Wenig and Andrew Forsh, I think, as well, on the original one.
Yes, Andrew and I had the co-byline on the original story about the deal talks.
Excellent. Well, anyway, we broke that story, and I think the big thing ever since then has been LPL saying that they're targeting a 90% retention rate of those 3,000
advisors, 285 billion in assets.
Okay. Commonwealth advisors. And obviously a lot of other firms sort of thought otherwise. Thought, well, hang on, we can get some of those advisors. They're now up for grabs. What's the situation, Ian? What's going on? How far away are LPL to sort of pencils downtime? At which point we could say, did you get those 90%? And how's it all sort of going?
Yeah, you know, I sound like, I think it was Donald Rumsfeld. Bill Clinton. That depends on what the definition of is. So it depends on what your definition of pencils down is. So there's a couple of deadlines we could describe. So the first is that there's DocuSigns going out now for Commonwealth advisors to sign their retention bonuses. So that could be considered deadline one. The second deadline, in theory, is July 18th, which is the deadline for Commonwealth clients to opt out of moving their assets over. The third deadline could be when the deal closes, which is supposed to be sometime later this year. Then the fourth deadline, which is, in my not-so-valuable opinion, the most important deadline, is mid-2026, which is when Commonwealth advisors convert over to LPL's platform. That is the, and I'm getting more into U.S. political history, like the Obama red line. That is the line in the sand. There's no going back once you convert to LPL's platform and you have to move your clients over tape to tape. So what's new is that we have a couple of more details that we were able to break on the LPL retention offers, which we've spoken about extensively. They're offering Commonwealth advisors 50 basis points on all net new assets that they're bringing in over a negotiated period, which can range from 12 to 24 months.
That's once they join.
Post-conversion.
Whatever that deal is, we've talked about these before, but you're getting a forgivable loan, basis points on your AUM. For example, you join, and then once you join, you've got this relatively generous, would we say, deal on new assets coming over.
Yes, that's correct. So you have that coming in, and then the other thing is, and this is really relevant for independent broker-dealer advisors, is the payout grid. And so LPL has told advisors from Commonwealth that if they come over, they can convert post-LPL Commonwealth conversion. They can move over to LPL's corporate RIA, and they'll be able to keep north of 90% of the revenue that they generate, minus a couple of basis points for administration and compliance fees. So that's pretty interesting, because that's keeping a large percentage of the money that you bring in.
Are these two offers, are they standard practice? Are they unique to Commonwealth? Would LPL be offering this to most people that join?
Yeah, no, this is standard practice, but it is interesting to note that these are elements in there as sweeteners.
Yeah, got it. And what's the rest of the industry doing? Is everyone else sort of going, all right, fair enough, LPL, have at it? Or this is a little bit of a pejorative term, which perhaps unfair, but you know, are the sharks still circling?
I mean, if they were saying have at it, we wouldn't be able to write about it. You know, I'll make my one token pop culture reference is there's a Simpsons scene where Homer and Marge are at the cemetery, and the hot dog salesman follows them, and Homer buys two or three. And Marge asks, oh, you know, do you just follow him everywhere? And he goes, lady, he's putting my kids through college. That is me in this story. This is keeping me employed. So to answer your question, Cetera, which is one of the largest independent broker-dealer competitors to LPL, they just published a second open letter to Commonwealth advisors recently, offering them about 150 basis points on client assets to get them to come over. And I spoke to Cetera CEO Michael Durbin this week, actually. That'll come out this week, hopefully around the time this podcast airs, talking about his recruiting strategy and how they're trying to pick up some of these advisors. So the sharks are still circling.
Okay. When will we hear from LPL about sort of whether they've hit that 90% rate? I mean, maybe going back to your deadline question, what is their deadline for doing that? And I suppose, will they ever disclose, you know, how successful they've been?
I think that we'll get numbers. I mean, they've talked about conversion rates before when they did the Atria deal, which we've spoken about on this show before. So I expect that they'll provide us with some form of figure about retention. And it's worth noting that LPL said when the deal was first announced that they're targeting retaining around 90% of Commonwealth's advisors. They set aside $485 million, no small chunk of change, for onboarding and retention payments. And when they were discussing their most recent earnings for the first quarter of 2025, Rich Steinmeier said, as the CEO, that they are trending towards 90% retention. So according to LPL, it's all good.
It's all good. Fantastic. Well, look, as I say, it is a story that keeps going. As probably as that Wealthfront IPO and or, you know, sale. And Sam, is indeed your story on Carson and this ongoing lawsuit. So I guess, you know, keep reading, listener. Keep it on cityusa.com/RA. Before we go, Sam, it's your birthday. What are you going to do?
Going to Central Park, seeing a concert.
Oh, nice. Who are you seeing?
Yeah, seeing Rhiannon Giddens. She's a pioneer of the banjo, formerly in the, she was in the Carolina Chocolate Drops, a folk group.
This is something that listeners won't know, but Sam, a keen banjo player.
Not a banjo player.
What do you play?
Mandolin player.
Damn it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, close.
There you go. Just proved myself to be a terrible, terrible boss here. Didn't know it was your birthday. Didn't know what you play. Maybe in the summer months when the news is slow and we have pods to fill, we can do a sort of a live concert or something. Well, look, thank you both very much indeed for joining me today. Really, really interesting podcast, really great stories, and much more to come on that. But otherwise, listener, thank you as well, and we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.